speak. Right, counsel.
Your Honors, good morning. My name is Paul Bauer. I represent Appellant Antonio J. Payton. Mr. Payton was convicted in the Southern District of Illinois of three crimes, which are undoubtedly familiar to the court. Conspiracy to distribute crack cocaine, the use of a firearm in the course of that conspiracy, and a separate count for possession with intent to distribute crack cocaine. As I say, the court has seen many of these. We think this is an atypical case for the following reasons. The main focus of our appeal is on the conspiracy conviction of Mr. Payton. We challenge the sufficiency of the evidence, we challenge the adequacy of the indictment, and we challenge his sentencing for conspiracy. All of these challenges are connected under the umbrella of a single question, and that is, what was the single conspiracy for which Antonio Payton was indicted, convicted, and sentenced?
Could I go through what I think it might have been and see what...
Judge, you can certainly can.
All right. Here's the circumstantial evidence. Mr. Payton's girlfriend is storing his cash and crack and counting his money. Mr. Woolley and Daddy Milton are runners, earning commissions. Jay is running crack to Payton and Churl, treating them as a unit. In other words, cutting off one when the other one falls behind in the payments, and Churl and Payton are supplying each other with crack to sell when one of them ran out. What I'm wondering is, what more do we need?
Let me address what I think is the biggest element there that you've talked about, and the one that appears in many cases, and that I think is the fronting of crack cocaine by Jay. Fronting is typically viewed as one of the indicia of a conspiracy because fronting indicates a level of mutual, a sufficient level of mutual trust. In other words, it indicates that the two parties are sharing risk in the enterprise. This case is different from that because the evidence showed that what the government characterized as fronting was when on an indeterminate number of times before they started paying up front, this person, Jay, would sell them crack cocaine, $600 worth, but charge them $1,000 because they were paying later. I would submit that's different from what you think of when you think of sharing the risk. He's not sharing the risk with them. He's forcing them to pay for the risk. He's essentially acting as a loan shark, charging them a vigorish for the amount of money that they're going to pay back later. That's not the level of trust that I believe indicates a conspiracy, and the fact that it's not a level of trust is shown by the fact that the instant that they didn't pay him on time, he cut them off.
Them.
And
so what does that prove? Maybe he wants to donate those extra funds to the United Fund.
I don't think...
You don't know what he's going to do with it.
I don't know what he's going to do with it, but, Your Honor, what that shows is, just like any other, if it's an enterprise that they're sharing, when they front money, they front you $1,000 worth of cocaine to return $1,000. Here he's forcing them to pay for their risk. He's not sharing the risk with them.
That's a good theory, but have you seen that upheld at all? You can't find any case law supporting that theory other than that 411, can you?
The answer to that is no, Your Honor.
All right.
Okay. The other issue that you raised, and then the sort of the second step down from that, is that he cut off both of them, in that this person, Jay, considered them to be a unit. But the fact that he considered them to be a unit doesn't mean that they were a unit.
We're talking about circumstantial evidence, aren't we?
We are, Your Honor.
Yeah. I mean, it could be viewed that they were a unit.
Except in this case, we have the testimony of Sharon Sherrill where he's asked, did you have an agreement with Antonio Payton? And the answer is, no, I didn't have an agreement with him. And the government says, well, he may not have understood that what he had was an agreement, but the jury did. Well, I think that's good logic, except for the essence of a conspiracy is a meeting of minds, an agreement. And if the minds that are meeting don't understand that what they're doing is an agreement, we don't believe that constitutes a meeting of minds. The essence of our argument in this case flows from the government's closing argument, which when they say at the end of evidence that there are agreements all over the place in this case. And it's our view that if you get to the end of the trial and you say there's agreements all over the place, you haven't proved the single agreement that you said you were going to prove at the outset. Now, how do they try to salvage that? Well, they say now that Antonio Payton was the hub of this conspiracy. This small-time retail street drug dealer was the hub of the conspiracy. And they posit that the goal of this conspiracy was that Antonio Payton wanted to be a big-time crack dealer and wanted to have a nice car with nice rims and a nice clothes. There was no evidence ever in any place in the record that anyone else shared that as their common goal. Second, the government's closing statement where they say that there are agreements all over the place is a concession. We believe that they had proved multiple conspiracies. There is thus a variance between the indictment and the government's proof of trial. And we believe it's a fatal variance because it's obvious that he was deprived of an adequate opportunity to prepare a defense by definition because the government's theory had changed from the beginning of the trial to the end of the trial. Third, we believe the government's shift to agreements all over the place also calls into question the adequacy of the indictment under which he was tried, and we briefed this at length, and I won't belabor that here. Fourth, we believe the government's theory of agreements all over the place also calls into question the sentencing of Antonio Payton for conspiracy. The trial judge assumed that any and all drugs that the court had estimated that Antonio Payton handled, sold over a three-year period were connected to the conspiracy, but the court never, in doing that, defined what the conspiracy was. Ultimately, Your Honors, what we're talking about here, in our view, is fairness. We think this case pushes the outside of the envelope of conspiracy law. The government says we can have a content-free, bare-bones indictment followed by a trial in which they throw everything at the wall and hope that something sticks, and then tell the jury in their closing to fill in the blanks and choose what agreement they like. We think that goes too far. We think that's the loose practice that Justice Jackson identified in Krulwich as constituting a serious threat to fairness in our administration of justice, and we ask that the court reverse.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Amanda Robertson. I represent the appellee, United States. opposing counsel gets up here and the first thing they say is the question all comes down to what was the single conspiracy. And that's the problem here, because ultimately juries are the body that is supposed to get the first crack, supposed to get the crack at, is there no conspiracy, is there one conspiracy, or are there multiple conspiracies? In this case, we believe the sufficiency of the evidence on the conspiracy count is waived, because what happened in this case is defense counsel drafted a multiple conspiracy instruction, but they didn't tender that instruction. So they drafted the multiple conspiracy instruction, they don't tender it, and now we're on appeal, and they're saying, wait a minute, there are multiple conspiracies, wait a minute, Judge Gilbert erred in not giving this instruction. And, you know, defense wants to say this is about fairness, and the government wholeheartedly believes the trial strategy, the trial theory during trial was there were no agreements. They submitted a buyer-seller instruction, and whereas defense says that's the court's buyer-seller instruction, that's not exactly true. Our view of the record indicates defense tendered a buyer-seller instruction, defendant's number 28. It was incorrect instruction because it listed marijuana amounts in the first paragraph. So what the court did is instead of giving defendants 28, which was a buyer-seller and was incorrect, he changed it, he corrected it and changed it to court 14. So the buyer-seller instruction was given, but it was ultimately given because that was the defendant's theory. The government's closing argument, which the defendant bases his appeal on, is there are agreements all over the place, was merely response to the trial theory and the trial strategy of the defendant, whereupon all of the crack users and the crack sellers that took the stand, the question posed to them on cross-examination was, you did not have a formal agreement with the defendant, did you? A lot of these uneducated crack dealers didn't understand whether they had formal agreements or didn't have formal agreements. So the government's response of there are agreements all over the place was merely response to the defendant's theory, which was there were no agreements. So what we have is at trial, the theory is there's no agreements, and now on appeal, the defendant wants to argue that there are multiple agreements. So first and foremost, the government believes that the issue is waived, and there can be no clearer waiver than drafting the multiple conspiracy instruction and then choosing not to tender it to the court. We believe that even if the issue of multiple conspiracies is not waived and is merely looked at for plain error, the government would still prevail. As Justice Roebner pointed out, we have Sophia Covington, the girlfriend, storing the crack cocaine and the money. Wendell Woolley, Milton Payton, and Anthony Barnett were running. They had an interest in the defendant being a successful drug dealer because the more crack cocaine that the defendant sold, the more $20 rocks that Milton Payton, Wendell Woolley, and Anthony Barnett got for running for him and taking business to him. Sharon Sherrell and Antonio Payton, and Sharon Sherrell was the charged co-defendant in this case. They were supplied by Jay. They were getting fronts, and the government submits that a front is exactly what happened in this case, and Jay was assuming the risk. He's giving them the crack cocaine. If he's giving it to them on a front, and that means he has to take a chance that they're going to sell the crack cocaine, they're not going to get arrested, they're not going to rip him off, he's assuming the risk, they have to give him $1,000. Whereas if they're able to pay for the crack cocaine up front, well, the amount is lower, and it's $600, and clearly that's a front, that's the only front the government's aware of, and Jay was assuming the risk when he was fronting the $1,000 worth of crack cocaine. I think that the evidence in this case goes one step further than even the evidence that Justice Roebner pointed out, because before Jay was the common source for Sharon Sherrell and Antonio Payton, Michael Palmer testified that he was a shared source. Michael Palmer testified that sometime in 96, early 97, he was supplying Sharon Sherrell with crack cocaine. Sharon Sherrell told him, some of the crack cocaine that you're supplying to me is going to Antonio Payton. So they're sharing the source. At some point, according to Michael Palmer, Sharon Sherrell introduces Antonio Payton to Michael Palmer for the purpose of Antonio Payton being able to get crack cocaine directly from Michael Palmer. So not only did they share the source Jay, which started in 1998, as early as late 96, early 97, they shared the source Michael Palmer. As far as the relevant conduct, we believe all the relevant conduct was appropriate. They challenged it on credibility assessments of Milton Payton and Eldridge Hartley. Judge Gilbert made credibility determinations, and those should be afforded great deference. On appeal, they changed from the credibility assessment to the, well, it wasn't part of the charged conspiracy. Well, it absolutely was part of the charged conspiracy. All the crack cocaine was crack cocaine that Antonio Payton possessed and distributed in Carbondale, Illinois, during the time of the charged conspiracy. For all the reasons stated, we believe the trial court should be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. You have 1 minute, counsel. Thank you.
I don't even think I'll need 1 minute. I just want to address one point. The defense counsel says that we've waived our challenge based upon the failure of the trial court to give him multiple conspiracy instruction because we didn't tender it. There's no indication in the record why the trial counsel didn't tender it. There's no record where the judge says, do you want this? And he says no. So there's really no evidence that there's a conscious relinquishment of a known right, which would constitute waiver. It's just forfeiture. It has to be, government is correct that it would then be reviewed under plain error. And that's
thank you, counsel, for accepting the appointment and the good work.